It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, or on Twitter at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer, WNYC. Today on The Brian Lehrer Show, Asif Manvi on his special place as a Daily Show correspondent.
When I got hired on the show, it was very clear after a while that I was their sort of Middle East, correspondent, their brown correspondent. But I always felt like such a bad example of a Muslim since I've been in more bars than mosques over the years.
We'll replay my recent conversation with Asif Manvi coming up this morning and some other recent favorites for this day after Thanksgiving. Rafi, yes, that Rafi, the children's singer, on his work advocating for child safety online and on his new album. Ad Age reporter Kate Kay reveals what she learned when she let several companies track her every move online for weeks. And the actress Gillian Anderson, best known as Agent Scully on The X-Files, on her own science fiction novel debut. But first, Jeff Chang. In a conversation we liked so much as it was happening that we extended it spontaneously. Maybe you know Jeff Chang's award-winning book, Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip-Hop Generation. In his new book, Jeff Chang examines the role of artists in culturally desegregating America, though he worries that media images now look more desegregated than real life is for most Americans. Jeff Chang is director of the Stanford University Institute for Diversity in the Arts. The book, which includes fascinating and fun reproductions of advertisements and works of art over the last 50 years, is called Who We Be, The Colorization of America. Jeff Chang, thanks for coming on WNYC today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So the historical arc in this book is from 1963 to the present. So let's start in 63, the year of the I Have a Dream speech, March on Washington. You describe a group of artists here in New York anticipating the march, but unable to come up with anything that matched the discipline of the civil rights movement itself. Can you tell us some of that history to start? Who in the arts was involved in anticipating the March on Washington, and where did they get stuck?
Sure. This is Spiro we're talking about, a group of African-American artists, including Romare Bearden. A lot of the big names, Norman Lewis, a whole bunch of folks. And I think the point that I was trying to make there was that artists have a different process than folks who are working in organizing, activism, and politics. And the idea was to try to figure out a way to support the folks who are putting together the March on Washington by creating images that would help to uplift the race. And I think that, folks would have debates, deep debates, about exactly how you did that. Did you do that from the point of view of representing your truth as an artist? Did you were you in service to the civil rights movement or to the other movements that were activated at that particular point? And sort of that play of questions proved to be something that was part of the process, but I think is also something that made them not as disciplined, as you mm-hmm. said.
Well, what was the alternative? Do you make art that is specifically designed to uplift the race, in that case, the black race, mm-hmm. Or what?
Right. Or are you, by representing yourself and speaking to your truth
as an individual,
representing the race in the best way?
Now, the first artist whose images you feature in the book is the cartoonist Maury Turner and his comic strip We Pals, which debuted in 1965. Can you talk briefly about We Pals? It's kind of an integrated cartoon strip. Right?
Yeah. Maury Turner was the first syndicated African-American cartoonist. And what was really interesting is he was inspired directly by Charles Schulz, the creator of Peanuts, to create a strip that was about kids but a multiracial cast of kids trying to figure out literally how to get along. The really interesting thing about Maury, and I think about arts in general, is that when the civil rights movement is successful in bringing down or beginning to bring down the infrastructure of legal segregation, it still can't tell you how to live together, right? And so this is where the artists enter. And We Pals, which debuted in February of 1965, before Watts, a couple of weeks before Malcolm X is assassinated, and before the Civil Rights Act is the Voting Rights Act is finally passed, is a way of actually saying this is how we can choose to live together. And it's, you know, something that's light and punchliney and allows people to see different ways of living.
That's great. You also have a Turner cartoon of what looks like a black GI with a Nazi armband on his uniform on a psychologist or a psychiatrist's couch. And the psychologist is also black, and he tells the GI, "Your case is destined to make psychiatric history." What was that about?
It was funny because, you know, Maury had this really light, humorous cartoon in which he was sort of inserting these kinds of images of desegregation into the funny pages. He colorized the funny pages, so to speak. But he also had these very edgy cartoons that he was doing in Black Digest, Negro World, and what later became Black Digest. And so the cartoon described, I chose that because it reminded me of the Dave Chappelle skit of the black Nazi, the blind black Nazi, right, Clayton Bigsby. And I was thinking, wow, Maury's doing this in like the 1960s. Years before, you know, Chappelle is
right,
doing this.
Who was considered edgy at that time.
Mm-hmm, absolutely, and still is in some respects.
Yes, absolutely.
So here, you know, here again, our artists anticipating being sort of prophetic about the future and also the role of race comedy in helping us to think about race in a different way.
My guest, Jeff Chang, his new book is called Who We Be, The Colorization of America. And chapter 4 of the book is subtitled The Invention of Multiculturalism. And it begins with your sentence, "Multiculturalism, what a waste of syllables." was there a moment of invention of that word?
I think so. You know, before the multiculturalist avant-garde begins to arrive in the early 70s, in places like New York and Los Angeles, but particularly in the Bay Area, the dominant paradigm, so to speak, is that America is of one culture. You talk about one American culture, one way of being American.
Integration and melting pot.
Melting pot, right. So integration meant assimilation to a lot of artists of color, and it meant giving up your uniqueness, your own background, your own cultural you know, sort of strengths in your history. And what Ishmael Reed was proposing at the time, and he dropped it into a little article in the Berkeley Barb in 1975, was that we understand America as a multiculture. And that, at that time, it seems sort of non-argumentative now, right? Non-controversial
yeah,
now.
Right.
At that time, to talk about a culture being multi was paradoxical. It was a radical kind of move. It was a breakthrough.
And so threatening to white people
and
who
so
thought they were going to be eaten by this.
I was probably like part of the first generation of college students to start experiencing the backlash against this. I was in the first freshman class at UC Berkeley that was predominantly non-white. That was more than 50% non-white.
Class you graduated what year?
I graduated in 1989.
Oh, uh-huh.
Yeah, so I entered in 1985. And part of this book was about unpacking the culture wars that break out during that particular time.
And in a minute, I want to talk about how we heard some of those culture wars expressed in the early years of the show, which started in 89,
mm-hmm.
and how I think it's really dissipated a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to go through a little more of the history first to bring us to that, because you have a section in the book later about how multiculturalism goes mainstream,
mm-hmm.
when
mm-hmm.
and how.
For me, you know, and I wrote about this in Can't Stop, Won't Stop, and I kind of really developed it a lot more in Who We Be. For me, it happens in the mid-90s, and particularly after the Los Angeles riots, when I think consumer companies, I almost have a picture in my head of a bunch of executives watching images of looters and saying, why aren't those people buying the stuff? Aren't we supposed to be bringing them into this sort of new vision of global capitalism? And so it's really interesting because what you see is consumer companies moving very directly in the late 90s from serving what has been in the past primarily a white suburban middle class base thinking about how to serve the world, which is predominantly young and predominantly not white.
Is this the United Colors of Benetton and things like that?
I think so. I think that that's the Benetton moment. I think that that's the moment which begins in the 80s. And after the 90s, this is the moment of hip-hop, actually. Hip-hop becomes the perfect vehicle for companies to pivot from selling into white suburbia to selling to the urban world.
One of your chapters that I think tells the story of sort of the height of the culture wars around this is something we talked about on this show back in 1993 when the famous Whitney Biennial at the Whitney Museum that was identity-based took place here in the city. And, you know, I remember we did at least one segment on the white backlash to the show, especially to the tags, and this is going to jog some of your memories, folks, that were given out to visitors that said, "I can't imagine wanting to be white."
Yeah, I can't imagine ever wanting to be white.
Uh-huh. How do you look back on the significance of that biennial?
Oh man, it was pivotal. You know, it was pivotal. I think that in some ways it was the culmination of a lot of these currents around multiculturalism. Again, at this particular point, what we have is a culture war in which one side is arguing that multiculturalism is going to lead to the end of American civilization. The chapter is actually – I have a chapter called "The End of – It's the End of the World as We Know It," right?
In fact, I remember we had a Puerto Rican activist guest in, I guess, around the same time, 92, 93 – and I asked him this question that people kept raising in the media: isn't this going to lead to the Balkanization of America? Mm-hmm. I remember this is 1992. And he said, "I'd be more concerned about the Balkanization of the Balkans," as the Bosnia wars and genocides were breaking out.
Yeah.
Saying, "Hey, you know, we're still going to be all Americans here, but we're going to respect our identities."
It was interesting. I mean, you had that on the one hand, and you had, on the other hand, sort of, again, like, you know, your guest was mentioning at that time, sort of this vision of, well, look, there's all of this cultural difference here. If we looked at it that way and understand that the exchange is where all of the vitality comes from, all of the interesting things come out of, then we might be moving somewhere. And I think that that's something that's come back around, actually, in recent years. And that's what led to actually writing the book.
And I guess with 20 years of hindsight, the meaning of giving out those tags, "I can't imagine ever wanting to be white," mm-hmm. was a consciousness-raising exercise to let mostly white patrons to the Whitney think about racial self-hate that minority cultures experience so much?
I think that was probably part of it. I mean, it was really interesting when I interviewed – Daniel Joseph Martinez was the artist who created these museum tags. And when I interviewed him about it, I said, you know, "Were you thinking about the debates that were happening around the Harlem Renaissance around black is beautiful, around, you know, this notion that you should be proud of who you are and where you come from?" And then folks on the other side, saying, you know, George Schuyler, Langston Hughes saying that, "Black is beautiful." And on the other side, George Schuyler saying, "Hey, you know what? We're all Americans actually here. Let's not fool ourselves. Like, we're all in this together," type of thing.
Right.
And were you thinking about those debates? And he said, "No, actually I wasn't." But he had captured something of that, you know, of that internal double consciousness that, you know, people of color continue to experience every day.
Jeff Chang, author of Who We Be, The Colorization of America. And so picking up on that, thinking about it in the 25-year frame that we've been using in our anniversary series, the political heat around multiculturalism seems to have evaporated quite a bit. Mostly I don't hear the white backlash on the phones the way that I once did to the idea of what we call multiculturalism, of teaching history through different cultural perspectives, or that diverse people living in the real world would identify strongly with their particular heritage in addition to being American. I think people more broadly than ever before accept that as just normal and common sense. Does it look like that to you?
I think that multiculturalism has been successful in a lot of ways, and one is to reset the bounds of civility, right? So that that we have ways that we're able to discuss these types of things. But it's only been partial. You know, I think that what multiculturalism has taught us is what not to say, in some ways, but it hasn't necessarily taught us what to say next. And so the thing that we need to get to is still to have this conversation about inequity and inequality. And so that's a lot of what
Absolutely.
The book
and
is about.
Still very difficult conversations.
Absolutely.
And maybe it's, you know, easy for me as a white person to sit here and say, oh, look at all the progress that white people have made. But I do definitely feel like I hear a difference, especially among white callers from in past years. And at the same time, I think ethnic nationalism in any hardcore sense has lost. And so to generalize or maybe overgeneralize, it seems to me that people, at least in New York, you know, by and large, want serious respect for their differences, but then also just want to live in an integrated America with a lot of common identity as well, not instead of, but as well, which I think was always the multicultural ideal.
Yeah. And I think that that's certainly well established, but we still can't have this discussion about inequity and inequality. And that's really real. You know, a lot of the polls revealed that after Ferguson, a lot of the polls last year as well after the George Zimmerman verdict revealed this sort of divide in even the way that we talk about it. So there's gaps in wealth, there's gaps in income. You know, folks of color are on the other side of that gap in wealth and income, in home ownership and educational achievement and attainment. And also they're on the other side of the gap in terms of the way that we think and talk about and what we tell our children about race as well.
And these conversations keep breaking out one by one by one around inequity, around injustice. Like I think the national conversation about marijuana, regardless of Colorado and Washington State, legalizing recreational marijuana has really changed from kind of a baby boom, hippie, oh, should we bust people using marijuana conversation, to the criminal justice system and the amount of unnecessary contact that young people of color have with the criminal justice system, and how it affects their futures for having a little bit of pot in public while white people are smoking it in their middle-class homes and being left alone. That I think that's just an example of how the conversation is changing and needs to change so that we keep focusing on these inequity issues.
Absolutely. And so that's the paradox that we're in, right? On the one hand, we have cultural desegregation. We have the ABC fall lineup, you know, in which, you know, women of color and families of color are centered. And then on the other hand, we have this halting conversation. We're able to move forward, as you mentioned, on certain kinds of issues. But we also have these sort of moments where there are explosions, where inequity and inequality get put into our right in front of us. And we're not able to go deep with that kind of thing. We've also figured out a ritual as well. So somebody says something crazy, some celebrity says something really insane, and we've figured out sort of this ritual of shunting them off within 36 hours of the news cycle.
Who are you thinking about?
Don Sterling, right? Or Mel Gibson or Michael Richards or Don Imus, right? And within 36 hours, we've kind of buried it. And we haven't come back to it. And Charles Blow, I think, wrote this amazing editorial where he said,
New York Times columnist Charles Blow,
where he said, why do we only have the conversation when we have these horrible incidents that crop up? This should be something that we should all be pushing towards.
Because so, the real conversation is deeper than that, and it's subtler than that.
It's subtler
than
that.
But it's more ongoing than that.
And the whole sort of thing is, you know, people talk about 2042, right? This sort of magical moment where it all comes together, or this horrible moment where
2042 is the census people say that's when there will be no ethnic majority in the United States. White people will be under 50%, so there will be no majority by white, black, Latino, Asian.
And the main question I think that we have to ask is if we're all minorities then, or if we're all minorities now already in New York and San Francisco and Los Angeles and California, how do we form a new majority?
And I like to think that New York is emerging as a bit of a model for that. Not that there aren't deep problems. I mean, look at public education. We are intensely segregated in terms of housing in this city. But by the same token, the city is finding its way. And there's a lot of tolerance in New York City. And it's not this, you know, culturally all against all nightmare that those who feared multiculturalism in the earlier days thought we'd come to.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think that at the same time, we see, you know, rising tides of Islamophobia, right? And we see rising tides of sort of on the campuses, for instance, racial incidents. It's been a really interesting thing for me to be at Stanford University and see over the last couple of years students beginning to organize around racial incidents that are happening on the campuses, because I'm like, wow, this is what I was going through 25 years ago. Why is it still happening? And so in some ways, that's a sad thing for me, you know, a sad example of the ways in which the way that we see race has not changed.
Jeff Chang from Stanford University, author of Who We Be, The Colorization of America, and Edson in Manhattan. You're on WNYC with Jeff Chang. Hi, Edson.
Hi, how are you? Thanks
Good.
For taking my call.
Thank you, sir.
I'm from Brazil, and I went to school in the middle 80s, college over there. And even though Brazil is well-known around the world as racial democracy, just to give a perspective, Brazil population is like 200 million, and half of the Brazilian population is Afro-descendant or black. However, when I went to school, to college, we never studied Afro-Brazilian history. I only studied European or American whites. So, you know, learning about multiculturalism, I learned over here when I came to America, to New York in the 90s. So I learned about Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Harlem Renaissance, and other authors. So it was really an opening. You know, Brazilians like to talk about racial democracy. We are a diverse country. But when it comes to study, it's still European studies.
Do you think, Edson, that there's a similar conversation going on in Brazil? I think there is, but that's just from sitting here in New York and reading some articles. In Brazil, to what we're having here on this show and what's taking place in America today about these issues?
Yes, I think, you know, one of the good things about the Internet, you know, in all this communication, that people in Brazil, you know, Afro-descendant and blacks, they know what's going on in America, and they can relate it. They can look and say, hey, listen, look what's happening over there. And population in America, Afro-Americans, mm-hmm. they are like 13%, and over here we are 50%.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So blacks in Brazil, they are demanding now, they want to know more about
yes.
Afro-Brazilian
right.
history.
Fascinating. Edson, I really appreciate you chiming in. So the United States is not the only country struggling with this kind of conversation. And from the Brazilian cross-cultural experience, I think we're going to get a Canadian one now from Sudha in Fort Greene. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. Judging by the comment from your guest that graduated in 1989, we're roughly the same age, except I'm from Canada, and the difference is I grew up under official multiculturalism. When we moved to Canada in 1969-70, it became a government policy. And so it was very interesting to see at that time in Canada how new immigrants were coming from all over the world, particularly from South Asia, Caribbean, and a policy sort of anticipated a lived reality that ultimately occurred. I think that had both beneficial consequences as well as some unintended consequences. I remember very clearly when that term people of color started being used on campuses across Canada, and I felt very, I don't know, for at that time I felt very uncomfortable having my identity, which is a very complex thing, being defined by a color, and at least that was my position now. Now I'm much more comfortable with it.
What's your own background, roughly?
Oh, I'm from South Asia. I'm from India. I'm South India, in fact.
Uh-huh.
And I was born in India and moved to Toronto as a young boy. And we used to come to the States a lot to visit. And we were always taught in school that, well, America's a melting pot and we have a cultural mosaic.
Mm.
And when I came to the U.S., I'm like, well, this is not really a melting pot. I would visit my cousins in Long Island and in Queens and would go to Indian temples and have Indian food and we'd hang out. And they would have friends from different races. And so I'm like, it's really not that different. But then the sort of larger media argument, it was this huge issue here I could never quite understand. And I was wondering if your guest could shed some light on that.
Wow, this is an amazing conversation. I grew up in Honolulu, Hawaii. So I grew up actually in a culture that was already a place that was already, you know, quote unquote majority minority. And so I think that drives a lot of what I'm interested in. I also grew up in a family, you know, people talk about changing demographics. I can talk about changing demographics. I grew up in a family where folks had, you know, intermarried for many generations. And so that provided to me kind of a different kind of model as well. So I can really relate actually to hearing stories about Canada and Brazil here. People often talk about Brazil being a model. People also talk about Canada being a model. I think the U.S. actually has a lot to learn from the histories of multiculturalism in Brazil and in Canada. And, you know, 1973 is the year that there was an official ministry set up in Canada for multiculturalism. That's also the year that Bob Marley and Bruce Lee come out and begin to change our ideas of what identity is globally. And so, you know, these are things that we actually don't have conversations about. When we have conversations about race in the U.S., it's very much focused on the U.S., and it's very much coming from a point of view of sort of an innocence, a sort of lack of context and a lack of history. So I'm thrilled that we're being able to talk about these different types of experiences.
What challenges or opportunities do you think it presented you, coming from your Asian American background, to become the scholar of hip-hop that you have and, you know, that first hit book that you had, which was about hip-hop?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I came to hip-hop maybe even from this post-multicultural kind of point of view where, you know, in hip-hop, in sort of the aesthetics of hip-hop, there's sort of a meritocracy. You step into the cipher and you offer what you got, and if it's good, then you get recognized for it. If it's not good, then you go home and work on it and come back. There's, you know, there's an assumption, I guess, that it's not open to, non-African-American folks. But that's never been true. Hip-hop was always an Afro-diasporic thing, and it was always something that was open to folks who wanted to embrace it and really wanted to come to it. It's built on a history of Afro-diasporic cultures and a history of oppression of people of African descent. But it's not the type of thing that is exclusive in that kind of a way. So I'm like millions of other folks who grew up on hip-hop. I'm a kid that came up during a time when hip-hop was offering us an alternative to what we saw on television. Even in Hawaii growing up, this predominantly sort of white suburban ideal that we had to assimilate to.
Basil in Williamsburg. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Let me just turn down my radio. I'm originally from D.C., African-American, of technically mixed origin, but being from the South, essentially, we've always called ourselves black. And I have a very ambivalent relationship to the idea of multiculturalism because being a monolithic body has served African Americans so well, calling themselves black. I do agree that the populations in Brazil and in South Africa, if you look at them, they weren't able to overcome what we've overcome because they were stratified into so many different
categories.
And categories, and being multicultural and being racial. Whereas here, no matter how mixed you were black, and that allowed us to be one monolithic body, and there was a lot of strength in that. So I'm always ambivalent about it, but I do embrace the idea that it allows me to bridge into other cultures and to be one with a larger group of people with a common purpose. But I did want to just see what your guests had to say about that.
Yeah, I think that thank you for that. I think that there ought to be some sort of ambivalence because in some ways the multiculturalism that we have now has been kind of defanged. What all of that neglects are the structures and the institutions that have been put in place that emphasize and reinforce in every generation anti-black racism. And we have to be real about that. And I think that that's part of the conversation that we don't have when we go to that sort of happy multicultural place is not to look at the nuts and bolts of resegregation and why that's happening.
Let me get one more in here. Paul in Red Bank. You're on WNYC. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I was born in 1985 when your speaker was first going to college, and I grew up in suburban New Jersey. And one thing that I always noticed when I was a kid was that if you were a white suburban kid who was really interested in, you know, non-white cultures, like when I was a kid, I was really fascinated by Japanese and Indian cultures, it was considered strange. Mm. You know, like other people would say, why do you like that? Like, why are you interested in something that isn't your ethnic culture? But now, it being, you know, I'm 29 now, I look at kids and I see that it's more normal for kids to be fascinated and to kind of adopt aspects of other cultures into themselves. So I feel like progress over the course of the 29 years that I've been alive has happened, and that makes me happy. And one other thing, just because of what I heard one of your other callers say about interracial relationships, for 3 years, I dated an Indian girl. Her family was from Kerala. They were Malayali.
Mm-hmm.
And most of my friends didn't really think much of it. I did have a couple, though, who said, how can you date someone who isn't white? And so I guess it's kind of two sides of the same coin, that while I've seen some things improve very much with my generation, at the same time I see other things that haven't really changed at all. So while I'm very heartened by the changes, I know that we're not there yet, really, in multiculturalism where it's not an issue. I almost kind of think it'll be nice with multiculturalism when it's not really a question anymore. It's just something that's accepted as normal and not asked about, like the question why.
Hmm. So well put, and so reflective of the theme of the book, I think.
Yeah, thank you for that story. It really is. We're really in a really interesting kind of paradoxical place. And I think that, again, it returns down to this thing of we have made progress over the last five decades. But on the other hand, we're in a situation in which, we haven't been able to address these longstanding questions of racial justice. And I think that the main thing for me is that I'm interested in having the conversation. I'm interested in not being colorblind. I'm interested in us not being color mute. I'm interested in us having these kinds of conversations that emphasize exchange. And it goes back to what the caller was talking about in terms of even being able to understand folks through the kinds of stuff that they're doing, creating, and again, sort of the central role that artists play in helping us to imagine different kinds of futures.
We're getting so many great calls and stories. This is like one of the best conversations we've had on the show all year, I think. Can you stay till the end of the hour?
I'd be happy to.
15 minutes?
I'd be thrilled.
We're going to continue with Jeff Chang, author of Who We Be, The Colorization of America, as we talk about our changing relationship with multiculturalism in the arts and in real life. WNYC with Stanford University professor Jeff Chang. You may know him from his American Book Award winning previous book, Can't Stop, Won't Stop, about hip hop. His new one is called Who We Be, The Colorization of America. And this is a great book to look at in addition to read the history in, about 300 pages. And it's got all kinds of images of advertising, of journalism, of fine arts, reflecting on how we see culture from different racial and ethnic perspectives in this country, and mainstream versus niche and all of that over the last 50 years. So Who We Be, The Colorization of America. I want to ask what you think the future of white identity is going to be in this country if we're heading toward a 2042 world where there is no majority, if the threat to people of color of assimilation in the background was that their identities were going to melt away into one general American thing, which is really white, And if the white position on that in the past was blindness, if you're the majority, you can't necessarily see that you're a particular thing. You just think you're the general thing.
Mm-hmm.
If there's no general thing, are there going to be, you know, white student unions at colleges?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
could they be something other than Aryan nationalism and supremacy?
Hmm. That's such a good question. And I think that it's really rich, and I don't really know fully the answers to that. A good friend, but I'll nonetheless take a stab at it, right? so I think
that's why we pay you the big bucks.
Right.
All guests appear for free, by the way.
So, you know, in 2009, my good friend Hua Su wrote this article for The Atlantic called The End of Whiteness, and it was really profound for me. It was really eye-opening in so many different kinds of ways. It made me think that what I was thinking about in terms of developing the ideas for this book was not crazy at all. And so the threads that he kind of began there, I've kind of followed through on in some respects. One of the things that's really interesting to me is immediately after the article comes out, you begin to see the renewal of the culture wars by folks who are scared of multiculturalism. And so these are folks who are preying on fears of a changing country. And we can include Glenn Beck in there. We can include Sarah Palin in there. We can include Andrew Breitbart in there. And we can include a whole host of other folks who were not necessarily themselves making outrageous accusations like Obama being a socialist or
Kenya.
Being born in Kenya, right? But certainly fueling that kind of fire. In 2010, Time magazine did a top 10 ideas of the year. One of them, number 7, with a bullet, was white anxiety crisis. And so, you know, for me, what that illustrates is our inability to be able to have these kinds of conversations at a nuanced kind of level like we're having today allows the extremists to come in and prey upon fears of people. At the same time that all of this is going on, there's a lot of amazing activity happening amongst young whites talking about how do we have a conversation about privilege, what privilege means, and at the same time talking about, you know, what does it look like for me to be able to raise my kids down the line in a society that's changed. And I think that those are ongoing. I don't know if we're going to be having white student unions in 25 years that are different from the white citizens' councils of the past. It may be a natural outgrowth of what happens, but the main point, I think, is for us to be able to get to a place where everybody can feel that they are able to come up in a society in which they're able to express themselves and their backgrounds and reach their full potential opportunity-wise. And I think that that's the thrust of what we're heading towards.
So the very beginning of an era of these new conversations.
Mm-hmm.
How about Ankur on Long Island? You're on WNYC. Hello.
Thanks for taking my call. So I just wanted to add to the conversation. I'm a young professional. I'm in my mid-30s. I grew up in New York City listening to hip-hop in the 90s. And, you know, and during that time, the socioeconomic association with hip-hop, you know, was different. And now, growing, you know, as a physician, my friends are physicians, and we listen to hip-hop and celebrate hip-hop music, and that socioeconomic status is not associated with us, but, you know, that art is still there. And I just wanted to add, you know, that's, I think that changed, and I'm always fascinated by who listens to hip-hop now growing up in the 90s, and it's, you know, it's across all boards, not just that one socioeconomic class that was coming out for the music back in the 90s.
Jeff?
Yeah, it's changed, right? It's changed quite a bit. The market for hip-hop has changed quite a bit. It's become mainstream in a lot of respects. In the 90s, in some ways, it was still an insurgent movement, an insurgent culture, sort of a meeting place for a lot of folks from different kinds of backgrounds. And certainly Afrika Bambaataa, the founder of Universal Zulu Nation, was sort of the visionary within hip-hop who demonstrated through just even the music that he played, coming from all these different types of musical genres, from a bunch of different types of places, from German music to Nigerian music to on and on and on, illustrating kind of the ways that folks could come together so that polyrhythm becomes a model for polyculturalism, this polycultural kind of practice.
We have a minute left. Can you give me a 30-second soundbite on the impact of Obama, you know, which started his presidency, started with talk about a post-racial era. You deconstruct the iconic Shepherd Fairey Obama Hope poster in the book, and you show it, and with, you know, Obama's face half in red and half in a kind of yellowy beige. Mm-hmm. Where are we 6 years into Obama?
We're sort of at this, again, paradoxical kind of point, right? On the one hand, we have a black president. We are celebratory of multiculturalism and diversity. And on the other hand, we have these rising indices of resegregation happening. And that's a strange and kind of unusual thing. But that's sort of what the book is about, that contradiction.
And the book is called Who We Be, The Colorization of America, as Afrika Bambaataa will take us out. The author Jeff Chang at Stanford University and in our studio. Thank you so much. This has been really awesome.
Thank you so much, Brian.
We'll continue after the news with Daily Show correspondent Asif Manvi, the singer and children's rights activist Rafi, Ad Age reporter Kate Kay, who learned quite a bit when she let companies track her every move online, and we'll hear from Agent Scully actress and now sci-fi novelist Gillian Anderson. That's coming up next here on The Brian Lehrer Show as we continue with some of our recent favorites. But first, the latest news live right now from the WNYC newsroom.
On WNYC, and I'm very happy to welcome now Asif Manvi, who you know if you watch The Daily Show. He has a new book called No Lands Man. It's a comedian's memoir of growing up Indian in the UK and the US, winding up as Jon Stewart's All Things Brown correspondent, chief Muslim correspondent. You may also know his one-man play, Sakina's Restaurant, which won an Obie and was made into the movie Today's Special. And Asif Manvi is about to play a starring role in the HBO series Brink, for which he also serves as writer-producer. Here is a sample of his Daily Show work before we talk to Asif. In this clip from the Daily Show, North Carolina precinct chairman and GOP executive committee member Don Yelton tells Asif that his state's new voting restrictions are just fine.
North Carolina precinct chairman and GOP executive committee member Don Yelton thinks his state's new voting restrictions are just fine.
What's going to happen as a result of this law, the process is going to have more integrity. Right here in Buncombe County, there's always one or two that voted twice a year. They don't know
one or 2 million people?
No, one or two people.
And that's one or two out of how many?
That's just one or two out of 60,000.
So statistically, there is enough voter fraud to sway zero elections.
That's not the point.
The point is the voter fraud does just barely exist, while racism, according to the Supreme Court, is a thing of the past.
The scars and stains of racism are still deeply embedded in every corner of American society.
Yeah, but you're just talking about racism, 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 as if it's like the 1960s, and it's not the 1960s anymore. I think the men in this picture would be ashamed that you're just throwing around the word racism so cavalierly.
I'm in that picture. I'm there.
Asif Manvi and sources from The Daily Show. Asif, welcome to The Brian Lehrer Show.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, how do you do a scene like that? Were those real interviews, like with the North Carolina official, and he doesn't know that you're pranking him or setting up to mock him on national television on Comedy Central?
We don't lie to anybody. They know they're on The Daily Show. You know, they know what the show is. They know what they're getting into. Usually people are passionate about what they believe, the people that we speak to. Often they're people that no one else wants to speak to. Mm. And so yeah. they are excited about the airtime and, you know.
Were you thinking on your feet there, or was that like a written comeback that – you knew you were going to try to get in there about. So that number of fraudulent votes would sway zero elections.
I mean, when we go and do these interviews, we have questions, and we've done, often we've done a pre-interview with the people. We know what their position is. We know what their stance is.
Right.
And we do have certain things that are prepared comebacks if they happen to say certain things that, you know, that we know that they believe.
Yes.
And then other things are completely in the moment, because these interviews never go as you plan them or think they're going to go. They usually,
even on this show, they never go the way
you know this, you know. So and in this in this particular case, it was a perfect example of an interview that went in a direction that we never expected, where he just started throwing out all of these racial slurs and, you know, talking about how he painted a cartoon of Obama as a witch doctor and this stuff, and started using the N-word and all these things. And that really led us down a whole other path that we had nothing written down for, you know.
Sounds like you didn't have to say anything after that.
Sometimes the skill is to just stay out of the way, you know. Stephen Colbert said to me many years ago when I first started on The Daily Show, he said, you know, when you stick a camera in someone's face, they get a lobotomy. And you should use that to your advantage.
It's a great line. It's a great technique. I'll try to remember to use it. So the book opens telling us you came to New York at age 16 from Bradford, England.
Yes.
What did your parents do in Bradford?
Not to New York, to Florida.
To the United States is what I meant to say. What did your parents do in Bradford, and why did they come to the United States, to Tampa, right?
Yeah. Well, my dad was a shopkeeper, and he had a small business that he ran. My mother was a housewife. Who's raising two kids, and they decided to come to America for the reason that many people come here, for a better life. For, you know, it was the 80s, it was England, it was Thatcher, the economy was going down the toilet, and my dad wanted to get out of there. And he had an old school buddy that lived in West Palm Beach, I mean, in Tampa, Florida. Originally, he wanted to go to West Palm Beach. He had an old school buddy that lived in Tampa, Florida, and he told him, come to Tampa. It's the great new American city. And it was back in the 80s, you know. And so we ended up moving to Tampa, Florida, and that's where they are today.
One thing your father was looking for in the United States, he heard the streets were paved with brunch. What was it about brunch?
He came to America, and I guess he came on a reconnaissance mission because there was a real estate agent in England who was – selling homes and businesses to adventurous Brits who wanted to emigrate to the United States. And so he came to West Palm Beach with this real estate company and was looking at houses and places to – and I guess somebody took him out for brunch. And he was so enamored and fascinated with this idea of brunch. I remember him calling us on the phone and saying, you know, in America they have so much food that between breakfast and lunch, they have to stop and eat again. It's called brunch. Breakfast, you know what I mean? So he was like just completely enamored with this idea.
So he didn't get the idea that brunch actually replaces
breakfast.
Right.
He thought it was a third meal. And to him, it was like, this is a legal third meal that I can have before – before dinner.
and you had some conflict with your father over portion size, like the gigantic Coca-Cola that embarrassed you, right?
Sure, yeah. You know, the you know, look, my dad is a Gujarati, and for those of you out there who know what that means, is the particular type of South Asian from the region of Gujarat. We are known for our frugality. And so if my dad could get half off on anything, he would get it. You know, if he could find a deal, that's what he would do. So, yeah, it was very, America.
So it's like Jewish Gujarati.
Exactly.
It's drawing from my own heritage.
Yeah, Gujaratis are often known as good Jews within the Indian community. So Jews and good Jews are actually very similar.
So you get this deal on a gigantic soda for only another 39 cents.
Yeah.
And it becomes this conflict of you and your father trying on different American identities.
Yes, exactly. Well, you know, that story that you're referring to called the International House of Patel, which is in my book, is really about the American identity and what that means to someone like me who came here because my parents brought me here, and I sort of went to school here and kind of was I studied American history. I went to school, went to high school, grew up in America. And then my parents, who kind of came here for a different reason, they came here for seeking a better life, and our two versions of America, where they saw America as the land of plenty, the land of opportunity, the land of all these things that, you know, and then I started seeing America as a place which I lived inside and outside at the same time.
Right.
And there was and there was a criticism of America from my perspective, you know, it's like
overly consuming.
Yeah, you know, as a consumer culture, you know, I talk about the fact that there's a line in there where my father says, you know, have you ever heard America's the only country in the world where they will eat a turducken, which is nothing, something that no one else in the rest of the world would even think of creating, you know?
Turkey duck.
Stuck with a duck, stuffed with a chicken, stuffed with a sausage. No one else in the world would eat that.
It's very symbolic. And then, though, you tell of going back to Bradford, England to rediscover your roots
yeah.
when you were in your 30s
yeah.
after you had moved here at age 16.
Mm-hmm.
And you describe yourself being seen as having the overly friendly American demeanor
mm-hmm.
that is so often discomforting to Europeans. Are we overly friendly?
I think Americans, generally, compared to Europeans, especially the Brits, I think are definitely very enthusiastic. And, you know, there's a line in the book where I talk about the fact that America – You know, growing up in the UK, I always, as an Indian immigrant, you never felt like you were part of the British. You were British. You know, you always felt like they always looked at you as a foreigner. Whereas in America, there was an opposite kind of reaction, which is that Americans are generally uncynical, kind of open-minded people who have very little knowledge of other cultures and very little curiosity often about other cultures. And so there was this tendency when I came here for people to not really care that you came from a culture that had thousands of years of history and background. And it was sort of like, just pledge allegiance to the flag and now you're American and it's fine. And you know, there's a thing in the book I say where Americans assume that everybody in the world would be American if they had the choice. Surely, why not, you know? And Americans look at the rest of the world the way New Yorkers look at the rest of America, which is they don't, you know?
Tell a New Yorker. How did you wind up on The Daily Show?
I auditioned for The Daily Show in 2006. It was really just a random thing. Like they called one day, my manager called and said, The Daily Show is looking for a Middle Eastern guy. And I thought, well, this is a very elaborate Homeland Security sting operation. But they were actually looking for a correspondent to come down. You know, first I said no because I thought
not Middle Eastern. That
well, no,
thing.
It wasn't that I wasn't Middle Eastern. It was just that I thought it was going to be one of these, like, you know, I'd done these things where I'd gone on David Letterman and done the voice of Saddam Hussein or been a tech support agent on Jimmy Kimmel or whatever. And I thought this is going to be another one of these things where I end up pretending to fly around on a carpet with a turban on my head or yelling death to America with a fake beard. And so I thought, well, that's it. I'm not doing that, you know. And then they called back and they said, no, they're actually looking for a correspondent. So I went down there, didn't know really what I was doing at all, just decided I was going to impersonate Stephen Colbert. And they had written this Middle Eastern correspondent. They had written this correspondent who actually was from the Middle East. And then I guess after they wrote it, they realized we don't have a Middle East correspondent.
Yeah.
So they needed to find one.
Detail.
Yeah. And so they found me. I actually went down, auditioned, and got the job the same day, was on the show that night, and didn't even have a chance to tell anybody that I was on the show.
Wow.
And it just sort of aired. And then John has been great to me and just kept inviting me back over the next several months to be on the show and then offered me a full-time job back in 2007.
And the book ends with Jon Stewart calling you on the phone for the first time
yeah.
and asking you to do something
yes.
that you were hesitant to do.
Well, you know, it's funny. When I first started on The Daily Show, my dad said to me, if they ask you anything about Islam, if Jon Stewart asks you anything about Islam, don't answer them. Have him call your mother. She knows everything, you know. So cut to years later, I get this call from Jon Stewart, who had never in all my years at The Daily Show ever called me on my cell phone. And he called me and he said, listen, Trey Parker and Matt Stone are being threatened by this Islamic website because they showed an image of Muhammad in a bear suit on South Park the other night. And we want to do something on the show. And would you be willing to come on the show and talk about your personal feelings about this and da da da? And I thought, and my parents' words like rang back in my head, and I said, "Can I call my mother?" You know, but it was one of those things where I went on the show, and you know, and I always felt when I got hired on the show, it was very clear after a while that I was their sort of Middle East, you know, correspondent, their brown correspondent. But I always felt like such a bad example of a Muslim, since I've been in more bars than mosques over the years, you know.
You were going to speak for the billion Muslims
yeah,
in the
and
world.
And it's been a kind of strange journey as far as that goes, you know, like representing this kind of voice into the zeitgeist about Muslim American Muslims, you know, of American Muslims in some way. But, you know, satire has a tremendous power. And a lot of American Muslims have come up to me over the years and said, you know, what you do on The Daily Show through satire is much more effective than what we can do with the Islamic Defamation League or anti-Islamic Defamation League.
We just have a minute left before you go. I see you'll be one of the stars of – is it Brink or
The Brink.
The Brink on HBO. You want to give us a 20-second preview?
The Brink is a terrific show. It is a geopolitical satirical comedy about the end of the world. Starring Jack Black, Tim Robbins, Pablo Schreiber, and a terrific cast. And it's great. It comes out next year in June on HBO, and it is a it's sort of like if Homeland or 24 was a comedy.
Oh, boy.
But it's great. And it's The Daily Show, but in narrative form.
Awesome. Is it in like the is it going to be
satirical?
It's a satirical
comedy in the way The Daily Show deals with world events in satirical form. This does as well, but in a narrative form.
Sounds like fun. Asif Manvi's new book is called No Lands Man. In that book, when you tell your mother you want to be an actor, she says, oh, like Omar Sharif?
Yes,
because that's
absolutely
the role model, right?
Yeah.
Someday, some little brown kid will tell his mom he wants to be an actor, and instead of saying like Omar Sharif, she'll say, an Asif Manvi type actor?
Oh,
so congratulations, inshallah, and good luck.
Thank you.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. It's New York and New Jersey Public Radio. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And when you buy milk at the grocery store, you swipe your rewards card. A latte from your favorite cafe, another check-in on Foursquare, and that Uber ride you took last night from the Village to the Upper East Side, Big Brother was watching. My next guest conducted a three-week-long experiment allowing several data-gathering companies to track her every move, swipe, and check-in. And she learned some surprising lessons about what can and some about what cannot be gleaned from your on- and offline footprints. Kate Kay covers the data industry for Ad Age. She wrote about her findings in her latest piece called A Data Lab Rat in the Big City, Why Trackers Couldn't Trap This City Dweller. So what kinds of data did you hand over to whom?
Okay, so I ended up working with five companies specifically after asking lots more who basically said no. And the two really key ones were 4Info, which tracks mobile location data through mobile apps, and Catalina, which is owned by Nielsen. People might recognize that name from the TV rating stuff. And they track grocery and drugstore purchases through loyalty cards.
What do they usually do with that data?
Well, all sorts of things. So 4Info, their goal is they're tracking when I open a mobile app that's in their network, their universe of apps that they gather data from, they can retrieve the location where I was when I opened the app. So they have the lat long of the hopefully precise location that I was. And their goal ultimately is to pinpoint my household address. So they want to find me opening a mobile app or several mobile apps in the same exact location, which would be a residence. And then they would infer or deduce that that is my household. And then what they do is they work with companies like Catalina, and they attach the information associated with my household to to the location data that they have, and then they serve up ads to me based on that.
In the mail to your street address, or because they can just by knowing if they know your IP address, they can already serve it up to you digitally.
Well, it's interesting because that actually raises a problem with location tracking and location targeting that's been around forever, even just online, IP addresses are somewhat faulty in terms of determining exactly where somebody is, because an IP address can be associated with a server that's across the country. but ultimately, what they want to do is figure out, okay, we know this person lives here, and we know that according to the information that our data partners have, this person or family has X interests, they have this household income, they're associated with this sort of behavior, and so we're going to target an ad for Gerber yogurt to them or a jewelry brand or something.
So, spoiler alert, maybe the biggest thing that surprised you was that these data companies could not pin down your home address.
Yeah.
Hence the subtitle of the article, Why Trackers Right. Couldn't Trap This City Dweller. Yeah.
At least in this case, they couldn't, because what 4Info tries to do – well, 4Info has – you know, they have a threshold. They're not just going to say, oh, well, we found you in this address, this residence once, so that must be your household. They wait until they see you many times, and then they pinpoint that. So they didn't – I never got to the point where they found me in the same household many times. In fact, they never actually found my actual apartment. They found places that were down the street and another place up the street. And, and that's just a factor of living in a very densely populated city. I live in Jersey City. I think the stat in my story is like the 21st – most densely populated. I'm going to get the numbers wrong now, but it's extremely, extremely dense. It's like 16,700 people per square mile compared to a place like Omaha, which might have, you know, like 3,000 people per square mile.
So density makes it more difficult to pinpoint your address
because the
precisely.
Places are so close to one another, right?
Sure. Brian Lehrer with Kate Kay from Advertising Age magazine and her article, I love the title, so I'm going to look it up again, A Data Lab Rat in the Big City, Why Trackers Couldn't Trap This City Dweller. Did anything surprise you about what these companies were able to learn about you?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of eye-opening that, well, see, part of the project was these companies agreed to provide me the data that they collect on me. That was really the impetus for this project, because as somebody who covers the data industry, I'm always wanting to know, tell me exactly what data points you're tracking. Don't just tell me people are in an audience segment. You have to know a lot about them before you put them in that audience segment, right? So I wanted to really see what they see. And this was a very tiny glimpse at that. But when 4Info, for instance, supplied me with the data that they collected on me, I got a spreadsheet full of 60-some lat longs and, actual locations that I opened mobile apps, you know, while I was in those locations. And that it was kind of eye-opening to see, wow, that's like in their database somewhere.
So do they share with law enforcement? Like if somebody's trying to figure out, where were you on the night of October 23rd at 9:36 p.m., some of these logs might be able to prove or disprove or just give them clues if they're going on a fishing expedition about you.
I think that's a concern that we could have going forward, that, you know, law enforcement's aware that these companies are tracking this kind of information. And, you know, I guess they could subpoena the information. I mean, as far as I know, the companies I work with don't have any direct relationships with law enforcement.
And interestingly, you referenced a Nielsen report that came out earlier this year that said 62% of millennials said they prefer living in urban spaces so they can be near shops, restaurants, work, et cetera. Mm-hmm. No surprise there. We talked on yesterday's show about how millennials don't like to drive compared to their parents' generation, for which driving was a form of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Today, driving is seen more as a form of kind of being trapped in a vehicle, whereas living the urban lifestyle where you can take public transportation and multitask while you're on it and walk or bike to shops and restaurants, et cetera, that's the millennial definition of freedom. But what does it mean for the consumer data industry?
Well, so it's problematic potentially because, you know, these ad companies, all they can do is talk about we want to reach millennials. We want millennials to and why they want to attract these young people is because companies that have big brands, they want people to attach themselves to these brands early on when they're still formulating their decisions about what they like and what they don't and what they want to purchase. And so the understanding, the kind of consensus in the ad industry is that, you know, we want to get these people when they're young. So that's why they're always trying to reach these young people. And also people who live in urban environments tend to be maybe, you know, to use an ad term, influencers. They're people who inspire others to attach themselves to certain brands and to appreciate certain things. And so those are reasons why advertisers want to reach people who are millennials. But if they're all in a dense city and they open a mobile app and they can't figure out, you know, exactly where they are, it could be problematic.
Steve in Corona, you're on WNYC with KK from EdH. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I just was curious about, would it be possible for an individual consumer to get information from these companies that are tracking them about what information they have?
Yes. Well, there are a handful of companies that make that information available. But just getting back to the impetus of my study, you know, the thoroughly non-scientific study, they only divulge like general interest-based level information. They're not going to tell you, we found you in these places, or we know that you bought soy milk on this date at this particular grocery store. They have that information, but that's not what they make available in their transparency programs. So companies like Axiom, which is one of the biggest data brokers, they have a website called About the Data that you can go to, and you have to supply the last four digits of your social security number, some other information, and they'll spit out what they know about you, some of which can be pretty off and some of which can be, you know, dead on.
Steve, thank you for your call. Do they know, since you mentioned the drugstore loyalty cards, do they know when you buy? Because I notice if I use one of those cards at, you know, Rite Aid or Duane Reade or CVS, sometimes there's a discount associated with them, and
yeah,
it's very itemized.
Yes.
Right? So this receipt is coming out that says, you know, maybe you bought this over-the-counter product that would treat this condition or whatever, these kinds of food items.
Mm-hmm.
So how specifically are they getting that?
Yeah. So they have – so a company like Catalina has direct relationships with the grocery stores and the drug stores. So they have relationships with, in this area, like a ShopRite or an A&P, and they – they're the ones who actually enable those coupons right at the point of purchase. So, and the reason why those companies have businesses is because the CPG companies, the consumer packaged goods companies, they need insight into who's buying their products. The grocery retailers are the ones who have that information, but they want to be able to figure it out. So they work with Catalina to find out, who are the audience segments who are buying my stuff, you know?
Do your prescriptions from the drugstore also get reported to the data companies?
I don't – that is something that I didn't purchase prescriptions with this little study that I did, so I'm not positive about that. I know that there's a lot of health information and a lot of medical information floating around out there, but in terms of these loyalty programs, I don't know that that's even something that they want to do right now.
Thomas up in Pauling, you're on WNYC. Hi, Thomas.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. You're very curious that you're running this program because I recently moved from New York City up to Pauling, and I changed my voter registration recently to save on taxes on my house that I have up here. Very low profile situation. Don't really want anybody to know where I am. It's my escape. And so changed my voter's registration. The next thing you know, I have a barrage of emails and mail in my mailbox, advertisements, coupons, political announcements, et cetera, et cetera. And this is through voter registration.
Did you by any chance do a change of address form with the USPS also?
I did not do a change of address.
Because that would have prompted that sort of thing, but you might want to look.
I only changed my voter registration.
Yeah. Well, that information is publicly available, and that's an interesting sideline coming up to the midterms here. I cover a lot of political data stuff, and Those guys have access to our voter registration, so that certainly is available.
I wonder if there might be a couple of things going on in Thomas's situation, based on what you were saying before, Kate. It might be that he's getting the political ads because they look at the public data on the voter registration, but it might be that he's getting consumer ads because he opened some apps in his house, and they're much more traceable to a location like that than they are to an apartment in a dense city like you were describing before.
It's possible. I would say it's probably a lot less technical than that. It's probably, if he looks at his direct mail that he received, a bunch of it's probably current resident. It probably doesn't even have his information on it. And, you know, the people who are distributing the political flyers, they're just putting them in every house in the district, you know.
Did you want to say something else, Thomas?
Well, I mean, it's very specifically the voter registration, because I've been in this house for actually for years, and I just had to change in order to save taxes. So, and then I get hit with a barrage of political advertisements. I have things on Facebook. I'm just completely blown away.
Well, that is because that information is available, and political data analytics and services are becoming more and more sophisticated every day, and they update their data on a regular basis, and so they can figure out that you're, you know, they can attach information to your email address, and then they can match it up and target you on Facebook, and they can do all sorts of stuff.
Sounds like he did kind of isolate it to that change. So, Thomas, thank you very much. So what has you most concerned about this? I mean, you work for an advertising-oriented publication, which on the one hand means you may have some sympathy to this, to the advertiser. On the other hand, I know
I used to subscribe to Adbusters.
I was going to say, advertising age is journalism. You cover the advertising industry. You don't promote it. But, you know, there's also a generational split on this, where I think older people are more concerned about their data getting out to advertisers in particular. And I think millennials are more complacent about it. And I don't want to put everybody in the same box, but it's generally like, yeah, okay, we're sharing everything all the time.
Yeah, they're accustomed to it.
And there are reasons we like to share everything all the time. And we don't love the fact that corporations are glomming onto our data and bombarding us with stuff. But it's just advertisement, so what? So where do you fall on this spectrum?
Well, I've covered the privacy stuff for a long time, and digital media and targeting and tracking for a long time. And over the years, I've become a little bit less concerned, to be honest, because the information is typically not easily associated with my personally identifiable information. But also, I just think that, you know, the stuff's happening everywhere. We're probably not going to stop much of it. And I think the bigger concern is data security and whether or not a breach or a hacking attempt could, you know, reveal personal information about us. That's the bigger concern, I think, than just being targeted with an ad.
So
but that's just my subjective opinion.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, probably a lot of people share that. So last thing, you sat down after this experiment as a data lab rat in the city and looked at the hard data behind these 3 weeks of your life to the extent that these companies were willing to share it with you.
Yeah.
Did learning about your movements and learning what these data companies know about your movements change your consumption pattern or habits at all?
No. I mean, in fact, I had to download apps that I wouldn't normally use just so they could track me. So it was almost doing more stuff. But in the future.
But going forward,
not
really. Scare you off of anything?
No. I mean, I think because I'm so tuned into it, I was aware that they could do this stuff. But if anything, it just gave me a really interesting glimpse. And I hope to do a much more robust version of this study, hopefully with more companies in the future.
Let's see. Funny comment from a listener just got posted on our website. Karen says she's a medical editor, and when she sometimes works from home on her personal computer, she says, based on the ads directed at me, I suspect I'm on a top 10 hypochondriacs list somewhere.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, people think I'm tech enthusiast, and because I'm looking at stuff for work all the time. That's just the nature of behavioral targeting.
Kate Kay, data reporter for Advertising Age magazine. Her cover story with the cool Lower Manhattan and Jersey City cartoon on the cover is called A Data Lab Rat in the Big City, Why Trackers Couldn't Trap This City Dweller. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, the children's singer and children's rights advocate, Raffi. Stay with us.
Ring, 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 banana phone. Ring, 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 banana phone. I've got this feeling so appealing for us to get together and sing, sing. Ring, 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 ring.
If you have raised kids in the last few decades or been one, my next guest may feel almost like a member of your family. Raffi Kavoukian, you'll correct me on pronouncing your last name.
Kavoukian.
Thank you. Known by many, at least by many of your kids, or by you when you was a kid, when you were a kid, is just Raffi, is one of the most well-known children's entertainers in the world. He's back for his first album in 12 years, and he'll be performing in the city on Sunday. We'll tell you about that. But in that span, he's become a more and more vocal advocate for child safety, particularly online, building on his notion of child honoring, which he describes as our obligation to create safe and nurturing environments for children. He wrote a book last year called Light Web, Dark Web, with recommendations for both parents and policymakers on regulating cyberbullying and making sure kids are interacting with technology in a productive way in general. Along with child honoring, he founded the Red Hood Project, which looks to inform parents and educators about online behavior. So, Raffi, I'm too old to have listened to you as a kid, but I listened to your albums as a dad way too many times. Welcome to the WNYC
studio.
Well,
thank you for that compliment.
And in a minute, I'll ask you about our big revelation of the morning, which was Baby Beluga and When I'm 64 have a lot of the same instrumentation. Did you know that?
It'll make me go back and listen with a new ears.
And you do actually have a banana phone, right?
I brought one in case it was needed. You know, you have to have backup.
We'll
these
have
days,
to take a photo of that, the unpeeled banana phone. So what brings you to New York?
There are cool people here, cool radio shows to be on, you know.
Certainly that. Yeah. You live otherwise in kind of seclusion on an island in Canada,
I live on beautiful Salt Spring Island, British Columbia, on the west coast.
What's that like there?
It's between Vancouver and Victoria. It's great. We have farmers and chocolatiers and artists and singers and writers, and we have a speaker series that's all the rage, the Salt Spring Forum, and we're an enlightened community.
It's bohemia.
Wow. Okay.
Was there a particular moment that made you go from someone who said, I want to write songs that make kids feel safe, to you saying, I need to do something more activist?
I don't think of myself as an activist. I think of myself as a children's advocate. And if you make music for children, if you care about kids as whole people and you respect them, you want the best in the world for them so that they can give the best to society, why wouldn't you, take certain causes and move them forward? That's what I've done in creating the Center for Child Honoring on Salt Spring Island. Advancing child honoring as a universal ethic is what I've been doing for the 12 years before the creation of this new Love Bug CD.
And I read an interview with you where you said, before young children have experienced the slow rhythms of the real three-dimensional world, they're now subjected to the hyper-fast, flat, and shiny world of information technology. So you're not just concerned about bullies and predators, but also about screens in general for younger kids?
Yes, limiting screens. We used to mean television. We used to mean DVD, you know. Now it's the very, portable devices that themselves, as I like to say, the medium is the problem because they're too shiny, they're too seductive, too powerful in arresting the gaze of a youngster, right? I think that's one of the reasons Hillary Clinton just yesterday, I believe it was the day before, came out and said no iPads for babies, and I understand that and I respect that. Developmentally, what children need is the tactile world. They need the loving gaze of caregivers. They don't need a device put in their hands. So it's just common sense.
And more guitars and voice training.
They need the interactions of the real world, the magic that we're all about.
So we were just talking about younger kids. Looking a little older, A 2011 Pew report found that 15% of social media users between the ages of 12 and 17 said they had been harassed online in the previous year. So there are issues that extend well beyond the very young. Do you have specific recommendations for rules that parents should set for their kids about online privacy?
Yes, yes. As I say in my book, Light Web, Dark Web, every family needs a social media policy that the kids understand clearly, something maybe put up on the fridge, you know, to say, you know, that the parents are in charge. Here are the rules about how you use whatever social media devices are in the house. You don't take them in the bedroom after 9 p.m., that kind of thing. No computers in your bedroom. You know, these are the simple, common sense ways that parents can give some protection to their kids. Because the online world, as you know, Brian, it doesn't respect personal boundaries, and it'll invade at the earliest opportunity. So you've got to get kids to be digital. You want digital literacy for kids, and you want digital citizenship so that their online behavior is as respectful as you'd want it in the real world.
And you really get into policy reforms, too. It's not just about parents monitoring their kids' use of the Internet. You think it starts with companies and governments, right?
Well, where is the FCC? I mean, when we say social media, are these not media? I think they are. And I think it's a fantasy to think that we're going to have a civil engagement in the cyber world without some regulations. To me, regulations make sense. They're reasonable.
FCC, of course, is a U.S. governmental entity. You live in Canada. Is it different in Canada?
We have the CRTC, and I call for the same thing. I call for them to, get into making the most basic regulatory provisions that allow a more civilized online world.
Ben in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Rafi. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Brian, and hi, Rafi. I just wanted to share I'm a proud Beluga grad, as Rafi calls them, and one of the highlights of my childhood was meeting Rafi at the Clearwater Revival Festival when I was 3 or 4 years old. And my parents love to talk about how at that concert, the grandparents there, mine, 85 and 90 years old, loved the show just as much as all the children.
Thank you, Ben.
Yeah, thank you, Ben. And by the way, we happen to have a picture on our site of exactly what Ben referenced, which is Rafi and Pete Seeger at the Clearwater Festival 1 year.
But I think Ben was saying I was there 20 years ago or more, and that was the first time Toshi invited me to sing at the Clearwater Festival. The picture you have there, Brian, is 2 years ago.
Uh-huh.
It was my return.
So you've been doing it.
Well, I see.
You did it once
yes.
back then,
and then I came back.
I hope to come back again.
But that picture is beautiful because it's got one of the coolest cats in the world, besides Pete Seeger, of course, which is David Amram. David Amram is a friend of mine and a brilliant, brilliant American musician.
He absolutely is, and a brilliant conceptualist whose album No More Walls, for example, does just what the title says. He breaks down the walls between classical music and folk music and jazz.
Did you know he just composed something called Symphonic Variations on a Song by Woody Guthrie?
I did not.
It is so beautiful. You want to play it on this station, I tell you. It is really something.
Is there a connection between children's songs and political songs? I mean, Woody Guthrie wrote children's songs. In fact, in my own household, his and yours were among the two most commonly played for my two kids. But Rafi standards like Banana Phone and Willoughby Wallaby Woo aren't exactly going to start the revolution.
Well, you know, when you make music for children, you make music for their experience, which is early life. It's first impressions, and you want life-affirming music. That's what you do. You make it with as much love and respect as possible. When we grow older, we consider the world around us and how we might bring our best to it, which means a keen sense of social justice, that people like Pete Seeger and MLK, Nelson Mandela have been all about. And these people are not meant to be just made statues of. They are meant to light up our insides so that we carry their spirit with us in every day of our lives.
And Woody's children's songs were like that, too. Denise in Soho, you're on WNYC with Rafi. Hi, Denise.
Hi. Hello, Rafi.
Hello.
Look, I'm 61 years old, so I totally missed you. And I don't have children of my own, but I have an African gray parrot who's going on 24, and we have your music. I play him Baby Beluga, and we have your singable song collection that we just got, the singable song collection, yeah, with three CDs. He loves your music, especially when you do all the animal sounds and everything.
You play Raffi's music to your pet parrot, and you don't have kids.
I don't have kids, and I have his music for my pet parrot, because an African gray parrot is highly intelligent.
Should we be worried about you?
Should you be worried about me? No. He loves music, and he loves Raffi's voice.
Have you tried Mozart or Led Zeppelin?
He loves Louis Armstrong. He loves Aretha Franklin. He loves Frank Sinatra,
right.
And he loves Bob Marley, and he loves Raffi.
Get that bird singing.
The parrot with better taste than most Americans in music. Denise, that's totally cool. Melanie in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Melanie.
Hi. Hi, Raffi.
Hello.
I have to say, my daughter's 15 now, and I forgot all about Baby Beluga, but I actually have a question for you. There's a song that you wrote. It's on one of the collections, and it always struck me as a beautiful character study of a man who had lost his wife. And I guess the person, the character in the song is relating what a visit to this man's house was like.
Oh, if you're referring to The Changing Garden of Mr. Bell,
yes,
on my Banana Phone album, I'm not the writer of that song.
Oh.
It's just it's a beautiful, beautiful song. It took me a long time to rehearse it to make it my own, but I'm glad you enjoy it. It's a very tender and lovely, lovely song.
Melanie, thank you. Leslie in Hoboken, you're on WNYC with Raffi. Hi, Leslie. Leslie.
Leslie.
Are you there? I guess not.
That is such a cool name, the Hoboken, isn't it?
It is, Hoboken. Where did the tramps go? Ingrid in Ossining, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ingrid.
Hi, Raffi. I'm a huge fan and a musician, and
hi,
I travel. How are you doing? We love your music. We have it all.
Thank you.
And I get really incensed because I've read your books, and I love everything you're saying, and I appreciate it and dig it. And I get incensed when I see parents, while I'm traveling, farming their children off to the devices. Mm-hmm. What would Raffi say to them if he were in that situation, in a security lineup or on a plane?
He would confiscate the devices, put them in a basket.
That's what I want to do.
Put them in a basket and say, okay, you get these on the way out. You know, there are so many ways that kids were kept active, if you will, or engaged before devices and IT devices came out. Why can't we fire up our imagination and bring a spinning top, crayons, picture books, whatever? There's so many ways to keep kids engaged. That's all I say.
I totally agree. Yeah. And I've done that as a parent. I've been almost pushing my crayons and books and musical things in their direction, but there's a numbness there now. So how do you get their attention? I'm talking about the parents, and of course that's translating to the children.
Part of the challenge is that many of the young parents themselves were raised with too much screen time. So they don't think anything of, you know, they think it's, this cool thing that now the screen is in the hand. Well, no, it's actually, that makes things worse. So it's a matter of educate, 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 and that's what I'm trying to do with this book, Light Web, Dark Web, so that people will see that what the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Canadian Pediatric Society are calling for makes sense. No screens in the first 2 years. Give a child a chance to bond with the real 3D world. And after two, very limited screen time. And I tell you, when I meet a 10-year-old, it's going to sound harsh, but I can tell how much screen time that child has had. A child with very little or no television, or what we used to say, no TV, little TV, little screen time, is present. I don't know how else to put it. They're present. They have an imagination. They speak in full sentences. They'll answer your questions. Children who have been far too screen gazed, there's almost like an invisible filter between them and the world, and they're harder to reach.
Ingrid, thank you. And did you hear Ingrid's is the latest baby to make its radio debut cooing in the background on the Brian Lehrer Show.
She's actually listening to Mary Poppins, too.
Good. Multitasking. You're going to have a...
She'll be at Raffi's concert this Sunday with her dad. Because, of course, I'm always away when Raffi comes to town.
But you're going to have baby with divided attention anyway, listening to the radio and Mary Poppins at the same time. Ingrid, thank you very much. We have a very special surprise caller who we're going to get to second, who may have had his ears burning. But remember the first caller, Ben, who said he listened to you as a kid? Well, I think Will in Astoria has a relationship to that caller. Will?
Hi, Brian. Hi, Rafi. I'm Ben's dad.
Oh,
and,
hi.
Ben didn't tell you. He's now almost 27 years old. He learned that he had a toy ukulele, and he learned all of Rafi's songs. And I don't know whether this is a good thing or not, Rafi, but he loved your video. Oh. He had to have a screen to watch the video. And although we limited his screen time a lot, we never limited him watching your video because he was learning all of your songs, including the introductions. He could do the whole thing, including the line, and this next song is dedicated to my wife, Debbie.
Oh.
He was 3 years old doing all of that. He was a wonderful influence. Unlike Brian, I never got tired of listening to all of your music over and over again. And I'm glad to see that you're continuing to do good things, not only good music, but good causes. And I think it has helped my son become a better man.
Now, don't get me wrong. I love Raffi's music, and I think it's incredibly delightful. And we also had a Raffi video, which we didn't mind if the kids watched over and over again, because they also sang along and thought that was a pretty good thing in general. But on the 632nd listening,
well, you see, Brian, that's why you need new Raffi albums. That's why I recorded Love Bug, to give you some new material.
I knew there was a reason. I knew. So, all right. Must have been having his ears burning as we were talking about David Amram, who is calling in now. David Amram, my hero, I've never spoken to you before.
Hi, well, it's a pleasure to hear you, and especially so nice that Raffi has come to New York to help save us from the nefarious forces of bad media, negative information. And really, in terms of children, all we can do is try to give them healthy food, healthy thoughts, and some love. And rather than dwelling in the negative, which has always been there, and there's always been catastrophes, Raffi is 100% positive, beautiful, healthy thinking. And I can tell you, with my own kids, I called Raffi once to thank him because my kids came from school years after we met, said, Daddy, he's singing about you in the song. And I called Raffi. I said, Raffi, how could I ever thank you? The only thing that ever impressed my children in my life was being in your peanut butter sandwich, Jelly the Jam song. And Raffi said, I couldn't think of anything to rhyme with jam.
Peanut butter so sandwich made with jam.
One
for me and
one for David Amram.
I could say it in my sleep.
About you.
David, you are, I got to tell you, Pops, you're crazy. I love you. you are such a light in this world.
Let me
plug your books. Hang on. Let me plug your books, folks. You got to read David Amram's books. They're amazing. You want to go on Amazon, wherever your favorite bookstore, and ask for David Amram. He's written two books. I had to do that because you've led an amazing life, man. People got to know about you.
And David, will you tell me and the listeners if a story that I've always heard about you is true? That you were into different kinds of music, but once upon a time that was more scandalous than it is today. So you had this night where you conducted the New York Philharmonic, and you went from there downtown and you played, I think it was the French horn in a jazz club, and people in the classical music world were scandalized.
Well, no, I was the first composer in residence with the New York Philharmonic in 1966-67, but I found that Bach and Dick Spiderbeck and Charlie Parker and Gesualdo and so many folk musicians and Irish music and American Indian music, all these musics have in common purity of intent and an exquisite choice of notes. And they're all different. They're not all the same Burger Kingization of corporate slop of putting a bunch of trash together and giving it a title. It's not about that.
But what do you really think?
Learning, each one's like a language, like or a great recipe. Rafi, when he came to visit us, showed me the correct way to make hummus, and I still can't do it, but it's better because I spoke with the master, and it's that way with music.
You're way too kind.
No, if you speak more than one language, that doesn't mean you're schizophrenic or bipolar. No one said that Leonardo da Vinci was a jack of all trades. He was a brilliant guy that devoted himself to higher achievement on every level. Indeed. And, Rafi, what you've done, one thing I'd like to share with the listeners they probably don't know because you told me, when you asked to endorse some toys and get a fortune and you wanted to find out whether they were safe for children, and they weren't, and they thought you were crazy not to accept all that money. You said to me, little children and old folks don't have any constituency because they don't have that power, and you wouldn't do it. So you actually walk the walk that you talk.
Thank you, Dave.
Which is so rare.
Thank you.
And I know you don't want credit
it's,
for that.
No, it's a very simple thing. It's about respect. And respect has been the core value throughout my career. And if you respect children, how can you exploit them by direct advertising to them?
We'll have to see if we can get that hummus recipe, put it on our website. Hey, David Abram, what a treat that you called in today. Thank you very much.
Well, I thank you, and thank you for your wonderful show. And, Rafi, God bless you, man. We miss you and wish you could come south of the border more often and grace us with your presence. And your good music will always be here.
Thank you, David.
It's from the heart, and it's healthy, and you're helping. And when you help out children, the children can help out their parents and grandparents to grow up properly.
Thank you. Thanks, David.
Thank you very much. I was so... what was it? I was so much older then. I'm younger than that now.
Younger than that now.
One more. I want to take one more call because a father wants advice from you, seriously, on what you've been here advocating and talking about. And it's Alan in Park Slope. Alan, you're on WNYC with Rafi. Hi.
Hey, good morning. Hi there. Well, my situation is my kids are a little older, but I think you might find it interesting that when they were younger, we played a lot of Pete Seeger, and my little connection to fame is Pete Seeger actually played at my parents' wedding in 1949 because he was in that, they were in that world. But my question to you is, my kids are about, 11, and they're twins, and they only got phones very recently. And I find what's going on, that I would love some advice about how to, counter this, is they're listening to old or fairly old TV shows, and they love them, but they're frankly mindless, whether it's How I Met Your Mother or Parks and Recreation. And they're not quite at the point where I can throw something in front of them. So I wondered if you had some advice that you could give me for people, for kids who are that age.
Yeah, I wouldn't get kids that age, 11, smartphones. I wouldn't do that. So one thing you could do is take the phones away. There's always that option. The thing is, that, children will be involved in a number of behaviors, some of which you approve of, some of which you don't. So exercise your parenthood and get them making the right choices with how they spend their time.
Did you say Parks and Recreation is mindless?
I did.
I mean, come on. It's the Tea Party versus the Occupy movement. It's small.
I do know what it is. It's just that they've listened now to every episode. They know every single episode of How I Met Your Mother. I'm not sure whether that's a good thing, but that's a fact, and I can't interrupt them. But, they think about taking your phone away. It's quite a thing to do.
No, so, do it. Do it if you need to. I mean, that's what parenthood is.
Alan, thank you very much. All right. Rafi's new album is called Love Bug, and we're going to go out with a little instrumental from the new CD, right?
Yeah, this is Pete's banjo, and it's an instrumental I wrote on the guitar in open D tuning, a tribute to my hero, Pete Seeger.
Thanks for coming in, Rafi.
Thank you so much.
Coming up next, the Agent Scully actress and now sci-fi novelist, Gillian Anderson. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as a young actor, my next guest nailed her first major role on screen in the epic sci-fi series The X-Files. Agent Scully, played by Gillian Anderson, investigated extraterrestrials and kept viewers coming back each week before the age of binge-watching
to see how her and Mulder would carry on their quest for the deeper truths of our universe. Anderson went on to play Hannibal Lecter's analyst, among other notable roles. And now she's written a new sci-fi thriller of her own as the co-author of A Vision of Fire, the first book in a trilogy that would leave even Agent Scully's head spinning. Gillian Anderson, welcome to WNIC.
Hi.
For people thinking, oh, actresses can't write and writers can't act, are you here to disabuse them of that notion?
Yes, indeed. What more can I say?
Is it your first attempt at writing a book?
It is my first attempt at writing a book. I've been attempting to adapt a book into a screenplay for about 15 years. So this has come a lot quicker. And a lot of that has to do with my co-writer, Jeff Rovin.
Who's written a lot.
Has written a lot very successfully. Yes, indeed.
And obviously people know you from some sci-fi roles, among other things. Did you lean toward this kind of a book because of your acting career, or did you lean toward those acting roles because you're a sci-fi fan?
I would not have been approached to be involved in this book were it not from a previous job in a sci-fi series that I was involved in. And so that in and of itself has influenced some of the work that I've done. The majority of the work I've done since doing The X-Files has not been sci-fi related.
Right.
But this is the first time that I have been formally approached to consider writing a book, and it happens to be science fiction.
Are you much of a sci-fi reader? Do you have favorite sci-fi books?
I'm not much of a sci-fi reader. I am a sci-fi moviegoer. I am very fond of the genre in cinema.
What do you like, for example?
Anything to do with time travel. Close Encounters of the Third Kind is probably one of my favorite films. I've slowly but surely attempting to introduce my young boys to various forms of science fiction where appropriate. And
I always thought Close Encounters was one of the great forgotten science fiction films because it came out at right about the same time as Star Wars.
Yeah.
And it got completely swamped in, you know, sort of the public culture.
I agree, and I think it's timeless. There's something extremely timeless about that film.
Very, very personal. A Vision of Fire. Give us the blurb. Where would you start?
I think I've got it memorized. it's about a woman in New York City. She's a psychiatrist and deals with troubled teens. And she has a son. She's a single mother. And she has a very solid home life. And all of a sudden, she is introduced to a young girl who is having issues. She's introduced to a young girl who is exhibiting some strange behavior. The young girl, Manik, is the daughter of the Indian ambassador to the UN, and he has sustained an assassination attempt in the previous week. And since the attempt, his daughter Manik has been exhibiting some very strange behavior, and Caitlin is brought in by a friend of the family to help diagnose. And in the process of her research, she discovers that there are other youths who have been exhibiting similar behaviors around the world. There's a young girl in Haiti. There's a young man in Iran. And so her research takes her around the world and also takes her into the past, where she discovers that a mysterious civilization is responsible for the events that are taking place today.
And the writing is very visual, very cinematic. I think there's this voodoo scene in Haiti that is absolutely gripping. You can see the main character, Caitlin, being thrown against the wall as if you're watching a movie. Was it written with conversion to the screen in mind?
Most definitely it was. I mean, that was my my entry into my involvement was to create, my desire was to create a character who would translate to the screen, and that the through line and our epic tale would be cinematic enough that we could be having that conversation in short order.
With Caitlin played by you?
Quite possibly, yes, as it happens.
So I want to play a quick clip of you as Agent Scully,
okay,
if you can stand it, in the pilot episode of The X-Files.
Oh, my God.
The girl obviously died of something. If it was natural causes, it's plausible that there was something missed in the postmortem. If she was murdered, it's plausible there was a sloppy investigation. What I find fantastic is any notion that there are answers beyond the realm of science. The answers are there. You just have to know where to look.
That
That's why they put the I in FBI.
See you tomorrow morning, Scully.
Wait, why are you holding your head?
Oh, my God, I just got goosebumps.
Did you not like that?
Oh, it's so funny. I was on a news station this morning, and they played a clip from the pilot as well, but it's been a very long time since I have seen that, and yes.
But script-wise, character-wise, Agent Scully is definitely a skeptic, whereas in Vision of Fire, Caitlin seems to be, let's say, a bit more susceptible to believing in some other explanation about things.
Yes.
It's just an interesting contrast.
Yes.
So,
and I am more as well. I mean, I'm the irony during the series that David and I were actually had flipped places, really. I was much more open-minded, and David has a tendency to be more skeptical than his character Mulder. So this feels more up my alley than the consummate skeptic.
Open-minded in this case, meaning religious or
spiritual, energetic, etc., etc. All of which you will find in the book. But the idea that our civilization has a common root and that ultimately it's the book and life is about unity and not separation.
Charles in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello. Jillian.
Hello.
Big fan.
Charles.
Hi. What I was wondering is you had mentioned that you had specifically been thinking about translation to the screen and creating character in the book. And was there a particular cinematic style from a television show or a film that really spoke to you when you were creating this character that you had in mind?
No, as a matter of fact.
People always ask the influences question.
Yeah.
As if we model our work after other people, and sometimes
do. Yeah, we must be influenced in some way, even subconsciously. I can't say that I was in particular. No, Jeff, on the other hand, is a
your co-author.
My co-author, knows everything there is to know about science fiction and probably has read every book and seen every film. And it's possible that within his years and years of research and viewership, there have been influences from his side, yes.
Charles, thank you for your call. One of the most chilling aspects of the book, A Vision of Fire, I think, is how realistic and sort of current events hooked some of the themes seem to be, like impending nuclear war, the politics of the United Nations, the use of viral videos. Were you trying to seem current events linked in any way?
Most definitely, yes. We discuss Kashmir, which is a region which is at current underreported. And both Pakistan and India are nuclear nations, and it's not a small thing that there is constant upheaval there. But there's also – we are in Haiti, we are in Iran, we are around the world, but it's also a desire of ours to be socially conscious and show – different cultures and the way that human beings, the situations that they find themselves in today, the levels of poverty, the how religion affects our lives, etc., and to show human beings that we come to care about as main characters within the series of the book.
And this is released as the first of the Earthend saga.
Hmm.
So you're starting out from the get-go saying this is supposed to be a trilogy.
Yes, yes. And the second book is in process already. It will be a trilogy. It is a trilogy.
And if it were made off into a spin-off show or a movie, well, you're thinking more movie than television?
At this stage, I am. But we are, of course, open to the best format for it.
Children also play a vital role in this story. And not just as characters in A Vision of Fire, but as a main theme of the moral consequences in the book. And you talked about how you wanted this to live in the moral world. The adults are making these grand destructive decisions that the children then are victimized by. Is this your own place as a mother inspire you on this, or when you look around the world at the plight of so many kids in different places?
I'm sure both. I mean, as a mother, the thought of imagining myself in a situation as many parents are around the world, whether you're talking about Sierra Leone or Syria or Afghanistan, these are unfathomable atrocities that are happening today under our noses. And I cannot even begin to imagine what that must be like. And so, in a sense, it's bringing the human being behind those situations to the forefront and drawing attention to it.
Question tweeted by a listener. When will the next season of The Fall be on Netflix? She says, I need resolution.
Who says you're going to get resolution? That's not what we're offering. In the UK, it's November. I think in January, it's the US. But don't quote me on that.
The X-Files ran before streaming services allowed for binge watching of television. So audiences had to wait until the next week to satisfy any cliffhangers, like that tweeter who wants resolution. I don't want to do any spoilers about the book, but I'm guessing, and not having read it myself to the end, that A Vision of Fire being number one in a trilogy does not have a clear resolution?
No. In fact, the last scene in the book is, as you would imagine, so provocative that you will not be able to buy the second book in the trilogy.
Vision of Fire. A Vision of Fire, sorry, let me get that exactly right. It's A Vision of Fire, a novel co-written now by Gillian Anderson, taking on the writer role for the first time. So nice to meet you. Thank you for coming on.
Nice to meet you, too. Thank you so much for having me.
Something to give thanks for, the team that works behind the scenes on this show. Lisa Allison, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Mary Eileen Croak, Barry Finkel, and Shumita Basu. Megan Ryan is our executive producer, and Jen Poyant is our interim executive producer while Megan is on maternity leave. Our interns are Ben Mishiev, Rena Klieg, Selena Martinez, Sandra Mariaka, and Megan Tian. And thanks to all of you for listening, as always. We'll be back live on Monday.